broadcasting from Melbourne, Victoria. You're listening to the Investor Exchange. Tune in each week and listen to the guys from United Global Capital discuss the topics that matter the most to your finances. Each episode will help you separate the noise from what really matters, giving you timely and actionable information you can use. We'll cover areas related to financial markets, property, politics, personal finance, and the economy. Now, here's your host, Stephanie Sumner.
Very, very good morning to you guys in the studio on this very, very cold and frosty morning. How are you all?
I'm well, thank you.
It is good, doing good today.
Enjoying the cold?
I love it.
I don't.
It just doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel right without any football going on in this wet, in this winter weather.
Yeah, that's the missing piece.
That's true. 11th of June.
Let's hope so.
So what's the actual return plans? It's just playing without a crowd. Is that it? Is there any talk about crowds coming back?
Playing without a crowd and minimising the interstate travel. So South Australia and West Australia are relocated to Queensland, or will relocate, and they'll play each other, I guess, in a kind of conference, you could think of it as. Just playing against each other while staying in Queensland for 6 weeks or something, and the Victorian team's playing each other.
Right. Joel and I did walk around Collingwood's training ground the other day, and we saw them putting up very large fences to keep the general public out.
I think that was in – there was a an Olympic athlete that was training there when Collingwood came out, and they had a bit of a dispute the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah. One of the track athletes, because there's the running track around the outside, was training on it. And she argued with the coach that it's a public park, which it is, but the exclusion to it is that whenever there's a function on which includes Collingwood practice matches or VFL matches and training, that public must vacate. But she wasn't happy.
Yeah, you want to get into a stoush with the Collingwood club.
Nope. So she came off second best, but she made it known she wasn't happy.
Wow.
Who was the athlete, Brett? Do you know?
Yeah, her name, I think it's Morgan Mitchell is her name. She runs the 800 metres. She was a 400-metre runner that's now training for the 800.
Right, okay.
What about how did your weekends go now? A little bit of easing of the social distancing regulations? Did you guys all catch up with people? And
I did.
Yeah?
Yeah, I got out. Yeah. A friend of mine had a dinner party on Saturday night. We limited it to only 5 people, but it was still good.
Yeah. It's just good to have company, I think.
Yeah,
not
it is.
Company's not great, Joel.
Say it like you mean it, Steph.
It's just I've seen you in isolation for a long time. So.
Yeah, it's starting to wear thin, huh? Feelings mutual, honey.
Look, yeah, it is nice to have dinner parties and share with other people. Yeah, yep. Look, since coronavirus has been happening, I've got a few updates on things financially speaking that are happening in Australia. What I've heard or read is that scams have been on the rise.
Yes, they have.
There's a lot more phishing scams for IDs, and you've probably heard of the scam where people are stealing identities and superannuation details so they can make the $10,000 withdrawal from superannuation. There's also been a scam going around which is selling fake puppies. Ooh. Apparently,
I did see something about that. There's certain dog breeds, isn't it?
I don't know about the dog breeds, but the basic concept is that an ad goes up online to buy a puppy that's going to be delivered to your home, and of course people are feeling potentially lonely in isolation or bored or done with their partner, Joel and Steph. So they want to order a dog, and they pay up front for the dog, but the dog doesn't arrive, and then they get more emails along the lines of, look, there's been a delay with the delivery because of coronavirus, so pay us some more money so that we can get it through quarantine or get it across town or something like that, and the scam goes on. And apparently there's been about $700,000 in COVID-related scams in the last 2 months. Another one I've heard of going nuts is payday lenders. So short-term loans, just for people to go from fortnight to fortnight, from pay to pay, or month to month, and even though they might only charge a $20 or a $50 service fee on a small amount of loan, when it's a $20 fee on a $500 loan for 2 weeks, that's a few percentage points for just a few weeks of lending, which adds up to a 70 or 80% per annum interest rate.
Wow.
So people are getting themselves, which is typical of payday lenders, but people are more and more getting themselves into sticky situations because of it.
Particularly sad when people are already challenged with what's going on in the economy.
Oh, absolutely. But an area where the country has been saving more than $1 billion per month is in having pokie machines shut down.
Gosh.
Yeah. In less than 2 months across Australia, there's been more than $2 billion estimated to have been saved because people are not gambling on the pokie machines.
A lot of people would have turned to online gambling.
Well, that's the potential that they have. It's also that number is also not including casinos, who apparently report differently or through a different channel. I would definitely bet that there are some some shift to online gambling,
yeah.
But not entirely, because part of the appeal of the pokie machines is the machines themselves and the environment itself.
Yes, also the age demographic, I think, as well. People probably use that as a social outing and, you know, probably a lot of them wouldn't know how to use the online systems, yep, as well.
Yeah, there's the social outing aspect. There's the design of the machines. There's the environment. Where else are you going to get that sticky carpet feel beneath your feet than the floor of the pokey section of the pub?
There's a few seedy pubs around that'll have it. But, yeah, even they're not open fully.
No. Exactly.
No Keno to play.
That's right. So some up and down things that are happening as a result of coronavirus.
Right. Well, look, Joel, we might actually start leading off that Louis update there and just start giving a bit of an economic update. What have you got that you can tell us about what's going on in the market at the moment?
Yeah, thanks, Steph. Well, at this point in time, we've had a really strong move off the lows of March, off the March lows in most stock markets around the world. But we seem to, in the last couple of weeks, just be heading into a bit of resistance here, and the going is getting a little bit tougher just in the short term. We are starting to see some signs that breakouts, which were working en masse in the weeks prior, are just starting to fail a little bit and come back into their bases, where previously those breakouts were working and they were continuing to move into higher ground. We are seeing some technical signs as well in the very short term that just with sentiment measures, we're seeing that institutional retail investors are actually now in a neutral position in regards to how they see the market performing going forward. And traditionally, when we've seen this type of neutral sentiment and consistency between the retail and the institutional investors, that has tend to lead to some more neutral levels of market performance in the short to medium term. Seasonally, we are also moving into the seasons of summertime in the Northern Hemisphere. And there's an old saying in the stock market, sell in May, go away, don't come back to Labor Day. Now, that's related to Labor Day in the United States. And what tends to happen is there's a theory that runs about that around this time of the year, as Northern Hemisphere fund managers go into summer holidays, that they will tend to close their books off or put their hedges on and not be very active while they're away on their Mediterranean yachts and you know, up in the holiday homes in the Hamptons.
So where will you be, Joel?
Well, it's wintertime here, mate.
We'll be in Melbourne.
Yeah, that's only a US saying, isn't it?
That's only a US saying. That's right. So Labor Day in the United States is in September. So and seasonally, this tends to be the weaker months of the year for stocks. So you know, there are signs that we could be going into a bit of a sideways, choppy price action through this period of time. It might get a little bit more volatile in the short term. But I think overall we've still got some broader positive longer term, medium to longer term economic signs ahead of us. We've got stocks versus bonds in the United States. So when you compare the yield that you get from stocks in the US versus the yield that you get from the US 10-year Treasury bond, and this is an indicator of value. Typically, you would find that the bond market would generate a higher yield than US stocks do, particularly on a 10-year US Treasury yield basis. However, at the moment, the S&P 500 produces a dividend yield on average of around about 2%, while the 10-year US Treasury bond is producing yield of just 0.66%. Now, according to some research from Bank of America, in the last three times that this type of valuation gap has emerged and stocks have actually yielded a higher return than bonds, the S&P 500 has actually outperformed the performance of bonds by 31%. Now, that doesn't mean that the S&P 500 is up 31%. What that means is that it's outperformed the bond market by 31%, which could include the bond market selling off even further and producing a worse return. But still, it is a sign that for big institutional money managers that are looking for yield, that if they want to try and generate that income return, that stocks are actually much, much more attractive than the US 10-year Treasury bond market, which is essentially the benchmark interest rate for all other loans around the world. That is the effective risk-free return that investors can receive right now. So there is a positive valuation bent to stocks in the US, and that should provide at least some form of support to stocks going forward. The other thing that we're starting to see also is that the economic data in many parts around the world is still bad, but it's getting less bad. Now, traditionally, when you can buy assets, when they go from horrible to less horrible or from really bad to less bad, that has been a really attractive time to be buying assets through a recovery. So we've had some numbers come out of out of China recently, and while they're largely still negative, the rate of decline has certainly slowed down quite dramatically. Just last week in China, we saw retail sales, although they continued to fall and are down by another 7.5% in April, that's after a 15.8% decline in March. Industrial production actually rose in April by 3.9%, having declined by 1.1% in March. So factories are starting to get back to work in China. We've seen fixed asset investment fall by 10.3% at an annual rate in April, but that is a softening rate. That's on an annualized basis, and that is after a decline of 16.1% in March. So we talk about this second derivative, right? And it's the rate of change in the rate of change. And we saw this even during the GFC when we started to see that the worst of the economic numbers really occurred in October and November of 2008. The market actually found a bottom in March of 2009. When we started to see the second derivatives in the economy start to show much more of a favorable momentum, which is the rate of decline in the rate of decline is actually slowing. We saw property Chinese investment fall at an annualized rate of 3.3% versus 7.7% in March. That was in April. And we saw unemployment in China has actually remained quite resilient. It rose a fraction. It was up. It was at 5.9% in March, but it was only up to 6% in April. So the Chinese economy is actually holding up reasonably well, and we're starting to see some definite signs that the worst of what's occurred in China is actually behind it. Interestingly enough as well is that the Chinese have really only provided a small amount of stimulus. So far to date, the Chinese have only provided around about 1.9% of GDP as stimulus to its economy, which is considerably less than what Australia has provided, which is around about 12.9%, in the United States, which is around about 13.6%. So if we're looking for where the major growth engine could be in the global economy, it could be from China, who has a lot of firepower still left in the body for still left, you know, in the closet for it to be able to come out with further stimulus to kickstart its economy and perhaps kickstart global the global recovery in the months to come. So all in all, I think the way that we're sort of reading the market at this point in time is that the broad buying that took place in technology, healthcare, biotechnology, and some of the consumer cyclical businesses that were mainly online consumer cyclical businesses, appears to be stalling here. It's going to be much more of a selective market in terms of performance going forward. And in fact, on average, we would expect certainly the rate of recovery in asset prices and stocks over the next several months probably to slow quite dramatically. And we may even be range bound for a few months with some bouts of volatility in between. But medium to longer term, with valuations remaining favorable for the largest stock market in the world, with signs of improvement or at least bad to less bad occurring in many parts around the globe, we can start to see that the economies are now, most of the global economies are starting to tentatively open up. We can see that the short to medium term outlook looks a little bit iffy, but the medium to longer term outlooks still looks quite attractive and favorable. But the market is now going to have to trade on its merits. Whereas previously it was trading on the stimulus that was announced and making sure that things didn't get into a cataclysmic state. So we're going to see a market that's going to be driven much more by economic results, economic numbers, and I think that there's likely to be more of a wait-and-see approach before we see the next leg higher in any material fashion.
Joel, the stats you mentioned about China are interesting. It sounds like the recovery and how the global economy is going to perform is going to be quite well linked to the decisions China make and what they do.
Well, it's definitely going to come down to China and the United States. Now, yeah. The other thing to note here is that the US, remember, is going into an election later this year. And Trump just last night came out and said that he won't be shutting down the US economy even if there is a second wave of outbreaks in the US. And quite clearly, that's going to be politically motivated. But I think also many countries have probably got themselves into a position where they feel a lot more comfortable about their ability to handle perhaps a second outbreak. I mean, most of these shutdowns were the result of trying to flatten the curve, trying not to inundate their healthcare systems so that unnecessary deaths didn't occur. So I think with the number of ventilators, the preparedness of many of these healthcare systems around the world being in a much better position to be able to handle an influx of, you know, COVID-19 cases, you're going to see. And remember, you know, you've also got, you know, politics is very much linked to economic performance. And while I think that the vast majority of citizens will understand that in the short term they needed to take some pain, if that short-term pain turned into a long-term depression, I don't think that the political futures of many of these politicians would remain very resilient if that was to occur. So there's going to be political factors that are going to drive outside of just, you know, healthcare factors, whether or not these types of restrictions will come back if a secondary wave of spikes occurs. So, yes, China is likely to provide us with the first signs of recovery, possibly like what they did during the recovery of the global financial crisis. But we are still going to need other economies to join in as well, because China is a major exporter. And if the other economies around the world aren't buying their exported goods, then we're not going to get that positive cycle of economic improvement being sustainable.
Surely, I also had a question for for Australia as well. There's obviously tensions with the inquiry that's going on with Australia and China, and looking into the coronavirus and the origins of it. Do you think that that's going to impact trade between Australia and China and, you know, touching on sort of export market like our beef and other goods that we sell?
I think at the margin you're going to find an impact, but at the same time, you know, China is very dependent upon Australia for its to feed its own citizens, as it is dependent upon many other countries around the world. So, you know, we are all interlinked and we're all interdependent on each other these days. And while you might have these, you know, spats and flare-ups between countries, they're nothing that is new. These types of trade rows happen quite frequently throughout the ages, and but we continue to push forward, and we resolve those differences, and we tend to find that in most instances they're more short term. Look, you know, yeah, you can't deny that, you know, a little bit of a spat here with China could be an impact on Australia, but overall, I don't think it's going to be the major risk factor here. I think that there are other factors much more powerful that are going to determine our economic fortunes than a small little spat with China in the very short term. So, look, what I wanted to probably just leave our listeners with is just a quote from a gentleman by the name of a British historian. And he wrote this back in 1830. His name was T.B. Macaulay. And he wrote this in reply to the pessimists of the day, right? We cannot absolutely prove that those are in error who tell us that society has reached a turning point, that we have seen our best days. But so said all who came before us, and with just as much apparent reason. On what principle is it that when they see nothing but improvement behind us, we are to expect nothing but deterioration before us? Now, to put that into some context, what he's basically saying is that there's been pessimists forever and a day predicting the doom of mankind and human society. But betting against humans and continual improvement has been a very bad bet. And just to put that into perspective, real-world GDP, accounting for inflation since 1930, is up over 1,500% since Macaulay wrote that above passage. The cost of a candle in 1800, that allowed for 1 hour of use, cost 6 hours of labor. Today, that same amount of light costs less than 1 second of human labor. So even though we've had all these crises, we've had civil wars in the US, we've had pandemics, World War One, World War Two, Spanish flu, we've had all of these crises, we have continued to progress and move forward, and we've continued to innovate. And let's not forget that necessity is the mother of all invention. So we don't know where the next level of invention is going to come from, but most crises become the breeding ground for the next era of technology and the next era of innovation and the next leg up in an advancement in humankind. So for all of those who are thinking that, you know, our best days are behind us, I think it's too early to be so pessimistic about that.
Lovely to have an optimistic voice amongst the doom and gloom, Joel, that's for sure. Look, guys, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be back after this message.
Want to learn the strategies that have achieved returns more than double the return of the average superannuation fund? Each day, clients of United Global Capital are using strategies and tactics that were once thought the domain of the professional investor or the super rich. Book your seat at UGC's Financial Fast Track Seminars, where you'll learn the science behind selecting high-performance stocks and real estate, how you can participate in advanced strategies like property development, short selling, and international investments, as well as how to protect your wealth against major adverse market events. To secure your seat, simply go to ugc.net.au/events and select the seminar that suits your needs. Seats are limited, so book your spot now.
Okay, welcome back, guys. We're now going to talk about, we're going to throw over to Louis, actually, who's going to talk about superannuation ideas for people over the ages of 60 and other people that have been impacted, who are over 60 by coronavirus as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Steph. There's a few categories of people I'm going to be talking about and a few different superannuation rules and strategies. So before the coronavirus impact, and the coronavirus hasn't changed any of the rules that I'm going to be talking about. It's just brought one or two of them closer to light or applicable to more people. So with superannuation, there's a few ways that people can save money or save tax using superannuation. The first way is getting money into super. You can get tax deductions for that. The second way is when you're pulling money out of super and you're over the age of 60, then that money coming out of super is tax-free. Something that people typically don't think of is whether the money in their super fund and the money that that earns on investments, whether that is taxed or not taxed. Now, what I'm talking about is for anyone who is still contributing to super, and typically everyone under the age of 60, when your super fund earns a return, it pays tax on that return. It's a low rate of tax. Superannuation is a low tax environment, but superannuation still pays 15% on any income that it earns, and on capital gains that have a discount because the asset's held for more than 12 months, the rate of tax is 10%. So within a super fund, you've got a 10 to 15% rate of tax. However, when a person starts drawing a pension out of super, if they've met one of the formal conditions of release, then the rate of tax on their super fund is actually 0%. And that can make a big difference. So one of these conditions is reaching the age of 65. So as soon as any person reaches the age of 65, on their 65th birthday, they should be calling their super fund and saying, I want to start a pension account, please. What that means is that you do need to start taking money out of super every financial year, and there is a minimum amount that you have to draw. It's for people over 65, it's 5% of the account balance you need to withdraw from super over that financial year. But if you don't need that money because you're still working, well, then you can just contribute that money back into the super environment. But the point is, if you're able to get a tax-free status on your superannuation fund, if you're earning 10% return on your investments in super, if you haven't started a pension, well, then you're still paying those rates of tax within super. You're still paying 10 to 15%. Which means that you're losing maybe 1 or 1.5% return on your super fund. And anyone who's 65 years old, I'm guessing you've got an account balance of at least a few hundred thousand. If you've got a $500,000 account balance and you're losing 1 or 1.5%, then you're losing $5,000 or $7,500 per year. And That's a decent slug of money that you don't have to be paying. You just need to understand the superannuation rules and the strategies that you can use.
Why is it such a hidden kind of a agenda there? Is that from the tax perspective side to keep that sort of a bit quiet? Or is it just not knowing the rules for most people?
Oh, it's just not knowing the rules. And it's a bit of a, I'm not sure it's designed intentionally that way, but it's a bit of a hangover of how superannuation first evolved and then how it was modified over time. And particularly Peter Costello made some huge changes to make superannuation a lot more tax advantageous. And having this tax-free status over age 60 and 65 is certainly one of those hangovers that's still there. So it's a bit of a quirk, and you've got to know what those rules are and how they interact. But it's certainly a benefit that you can take advantage of. Now, anyone who is over the age of 60, if you're still in the workforce, well, then you should be maximizing your contributions into super. So if you're in the workforce and you don't have enough excess cash flow to reach your maximum contribution into super of $25,000 per year, including employer contributions. Well, if you're over 60, you do have the ability to start a pension from your superannuation account, which means you can withdraw from super tax-free and you can put that money back into super and claim a tax deduction. I've mentioned that strategy on this podcast before. But here's a quirk. So if you start this transition to retirement pension over the age of 60 but under the age of 65, this doesn't qualify for that tax-free earnings within the superannuation environment. So if you've got this strategy running and you're thinking, I've turned 65 now, but I've already got this pension strategy running, actually, you need to check with your super fund provider that you no longer have a transition to retirement pension and you now just have an account-based pension because you've met the specific condition, one of these conditions of release, that you've reached age 65. Now, here is one more quirk. Another condition of release is that you have you are over age 60 and you've had an employment arrangement come to an end. So it's generally thought of a little bit differently. People on the street tend to say if you're over age 60 and retired is the condition of release, but no, it's actually you're over age 60 and you've ended an employment arrangement while over 60.
Is that just like the contract ending, or what exactly does that mean?
Basically, it means you've changed employer or you've stopped with an employer completely. Okay. So it's not going to apply for a person who has been stood down for their employer right now. But if someone is over the age of 60 and has lost their job in the current environment or in any environment, even if you're going to go into a new job, because you've met this specific superannuation rule, this specific condition of release, you're able to contact your super fund now and start a pension being drawn out of super, and you can achieve this tax-free earning status. So again, if you've got a super balance of $500,000 and it's earning an average of 10% a year, then I'm guessing that you're going to be saving about $5,000 to $7,500 worth of tax every year.
Yeah, advice.
So look out for those conditions of release on super. This is really narrow stuff, and the wording might be lost on some listeners. So feel free to make contact with us, and we can explain it in a bit more detail and how it applies to your specific situation. But people who are over age 60, who change jobs or lose a job, they should consider making some changes to their super funds, not just because it might help with their cash flow position, but also because we can actually reduce even more taxes that they're paying by using super in the right way.
Louis, is it for people that don't have an advisor and are doing this themselves, is it just as easy to contact the tax office and speak to them about these kinds of issues, or is it better to come through an advisor and get that advice?
I wonder how you'd go about getting that information from the tax office. I don't even know.
You sort of really have to know these rules. Like you would need an advisor really to give you this information in the first place to sort of really understand it.
Yeah, and my experience from the tax office is that they are very well trained to not give financial advice.
Yeah.
And you might be able to word your conversation in a way that you do get the rules out of them, but they're going to really shy away from anything that suggests telling you what you should do, because it is financial advice, and that is a legal requirement that people who are not financial advisors don't give financial advice. So even calling your super fund, you might not get the information that you're looking for.
Yeah.
Even going to Google, you might be able to find those rules specifically, but you might not find the information on how to apply those rules in your situation.
Mm. I think that just always comes back to what you mentioned on a podcast, a while back, is that, you know, engaging an expert to deal with these types of things, whether it be a mortgage broker or financial advisor, is so important.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's right. So.
Yeah, yeah. And look, I was having a conversation with someone who is not yet a client of ours, but is thinking of becoming one. And I said to him, look, if you decide not to become a client today, then that's okay. But I absolutely guarantee you that when you are 60 years old, I guarantee you I will make you better off financially.
Yeah.
And every year that you approach age 60, that likelihood becomes stronger and stronger. So this person was 53 years old, and I said, look, I'm pretty confident that we can make your situation better off today. But every year you get closer to age 60, I get more and more confidence. And then by the time you're 60, I absolutely guarantee it.
Yeah.
There's just one more thing for people over age 60 who might have lost their jobs. Just be careful about doing this kind of strategy if you're on a Centrelink benefit.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you start a pension account from super and you're on Centrelink, you might mess with your Centrelink treatment.
Yep.
So, again, it's another complexity to look out for, and you've got to understand the interaction between these rules. But if you're over age 60 and you've had an employment arrangement end, even if it means you've just changed from one employer to another, then there's an opportunity to save tax on your super funds. And that's my main point I wanted to get across today.
Well, sounds like, guys, if you're out there listening and you're in that situation, you just need to contact UGC for a consultation. All right, guys, well, look, we're going to throw another break and we'll be back after this message.
Are you concerned about your finances? Maybe you're not sure if you'll have enough money to retire on. Or maybe you've received a redundancy, inheritance, or even a significant promotion, or perhaps a life-changing medical diagnosis. Regardless of your concern or financial position, United Global Capital's advisors are experts in the areas of strategic financial planning, taxation, superannuation and self-managed superannuation funds, risk management, estate planning, and investments. Don't let fate dictate your financial future. Take control today and contact United Global Capital for a no-cost, no-obligation financial strategy consultation. Simply call 03 8657 7640. Or email info@ugc.net.au and book your appointment today.
Okay, we're on to our final topic for the day. And we're going to throw it over to Brett. And Brett, you're going to talk to us a little bit about market analysis and what's happening in the property market.
Yeah, thanks, Steph. After we discussed briefly last week the analysis that Commonwealth Bank put forward in their modelling about where they see the property market going, ANZ have followed suit with their modelling and they've put forward that they're forecasting a national housing decline to reach 10% before seeing a recovery in late 2021. So what they're saying is that house prices will bottom out in about the middle of next year and they believe affordability will improve then, but they think that the recovery will be slow because the unemployment is going to be above 7% until 2022. Again, this is just modelling. There's a long way to come before this happens. It could be better, it could be worse, but this is their expected case on all the information they have at hand. The other part that I thought was worth touching on today is what's happening in the borrowing space. What are the banks doing? So we know that the RBA have already gotten as low as they can go with a 0.25% cash rate. At their May meeting, they actually were able to table some data that showed that around 10% of borrowers have taken up the loan deferrals being offered by the major banks, which is a reasonable amount. 10% is not to be shirked at. I thought there might be a few more people wanting to take that up. But currently it's at 10%. They also noted that there was still a significant number of other borrowers that are maintaining their mortgage payments in excess of what their required minimums are. So there's still a lot of people able to not only meet their mortgage, but actually pay more than what their minimum amounts are and pay more off their mortgage than the banks are expecting. So there's still, you know, some good signs, and obviously the incentives around, you know, with JobKeeper and JobSeeker are probably contributing to that in some degree.
Do you also think, Brett, that people might be panicking and putting more on there just in case, you know, money does dry up down the track and they're sort of ahead of the game?
I'm not sure that would be the way. If I was panicking, I don't know whether that's where I would put it. Similar to what Louis had discussed in a previous episode about having an offset account or ways you can manage your money around your loans, I think if I were panicking, I'd be more than likely to have it somewhere where I could draw on it to make sure I've got the ability to get to it. So unless I do have an offset or a redraw facility structured, I don't think I would be putting it onto my home line for that purpose.
Actually, I did speak to somebody the other day that said he drew out quite a substantial amount of cash when coronavirus first hit, just in case. And I thought that was kind of interesting, people's psyche behind how you think in a pandemic. So,
well, I think the masses would always think, you know, if they're going to have a reserve, they want it in liquid funds where they can get it as and when they need it. Just some other stuff on borrowing. So in April, all the lenders across Australia, so there were 81 cuts to variable interest rates for owner-occupier loans and 71 for investors. So pretty much everyone that's got a loan that's on a variable rate should have seen a reduction in the amount. So variable rates were cut by an average of 0.2% for P&I loans and 0.3% for interest only. And for investors, the cut was 0.21%. So anyone on variable loan, if you haven't received a cut, you're either with a bank or a lender that's not coming to the party, and you should be looking elsewhere. So whilst we're at record lows, now the lowest rate I can find, I've seen rates spruced of about 2.09%. The lowest I can see at the moment is 2.19%. The other thing that's happening that's playing into this lending scenario is the cashback offers that a lot of the banks are doing. I don't know if you guys have seen any of these. They've been marketed pretty heavily in the last month.
They've been around for a while, but they're more aggressive at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah, they're very aggressive at the moment. There's currently 13 banks offering cashback offers. So they're not new. As you say, Louis, they've been around for a while and they come and go. But there's probably more available now than I can recall ever being available. Usually there's one or two banks that might do it as an incentive to grab some business. But at the moment there's 13, and of which three of them are the big four in terms of CBA, Westpac and ANZ. The interesting thing with these is that the cashbacks can be attractive and they can be a nice benefit if you're someone that refinances every couple of years, you know, looking for a competitively priced loan. But over the long term, if you're just looking to get the cash back, but you're actually converting to a loan that's not the lowest on the market, you may actually be hurting yourself. And there's some data that Rate City have put together just to do some analysis on the current cashback offers and what they actually end up meaning in the long term for you. So the biggest cashback at the moment, ANZ are offering $4,000. It's only available if you refinance through a broker. But if you do go to ANZ and you take that $4,000, you're giving yourself a rate of 2.72%, which is probably a half a percent above where you could get the lowest rate on the market. So what that would mean, if you were to just have that rate for the 2 years and you had a mortgage or a loan of only $400,000, you would actually benefit around $1,800 by taking that cash back. But if you were to stay locked into that interest rate over 5 years compared to the lowest on the market, you're actually going to be losing nearly $2,000. So anyone considering these cashbacks really need to consider how long they're going to be tied in for and whether it is the best outcome for them. Sometimes the circumstances could be that they just want a cash grab to pay some short-term bills and this is going to solve that problem. But if they're thinking about it in terms of, oh, that's great, I just want to jump on board and get whatever benefits I can, they really need to look at the longer-term strategy. Because that interest rate, and Louis talks about the compounding effect, and as he was mentioning before with a potential client, you know, guaranteeing them to be in a better position in, you know, by the time they're age 60, well, taking a cash back now, if you didn't change your loan and you were still at that higher rate for 25 years, you've cost yourself over $15,000. So
if you've already got a home loan, is it better to do the research yourself, or would you go, you know, how would you go about changing the loan? Is it just about doing your own homework?
Look, I'm a big advocate for brokers. Main reason being is that if you're going to do your own homework, if you're not experienced in it and you don't understand all the ins and outs, you might miss a technical pitfall or some technicality about how the loan's structured with fees and charges that you don't understand.
And you think that would even offset if you're sort of, I mean, you're saying you lose money by taking these sort of cashback offers. I mean, then for a lot of people out there, it's another fee by going to a mortgage broker. Do you think it really is worthwhile?
Well, currently it's not really a fee using a mortgage broker. Most mortgage brokers are paid a fee from the bank. So typically when you go to a mortgage broker, you're getting a fee for basically no charge to yourself. And there, a mortgage broker will have access to, you know, sometimes up to 30 different lenders. So they're in a position to be able to analyze your circumstances, be able to test the market, and be able to really give you some quality feedback on what's going to be your best overall scenario. So I'm a believer, why not get an expert to do it for you, especially if it's not going to come at any additional cost?
Brett, just on that, there are some brokers, though, that do charge a an engagement fee, and a lot of the time they'll tend to charge a nominal amount. It might be $500, it might be $1,000 from time to time. I believe sometimes some of them will actually rebate that and offset it against the commission they might receive, and others will just charge it as a as an initial upfront fee. So you really need to get a good understanding of what the terms are that your mortgage broker is going to be engaged upon. The vast majority of them do take essentially get paid by receiving a payment from the bank in which they place your loan with. But then there are some that also have their own service fee that they place on top of the loan commission that they receive as part of their engagement. In the event that they do all of this work, find you the great loan, and then you decide not to proceed.
Any advice on how to pick a good mortgage broker as well? I mean, how do you go about one? I mean, how do you know that one's going to do the best by you, or you just got to sort of assume?
I think referrals are really good. Like, obviously, we know a number of mortgage brokers, and we've had a whole heap of experiences with them. So we've seen, you know, transactions go on through with a number of different ones. So we've seen how they operate. So we can give some good guidance there if anyone wants to talk to us or come through us. But typically, if you haven't got a mortgage broker, you're probably going to have a friend or a family member or a financial advisor, someone that would be able to give you some guidance. If outside of that, if you're not sure, the internet is pretty much littered now with rating sites, and that would be a good place to start. If you're looking for a broker and you're not sure, there's bound to be a few online comparison sites that would have reviews and testimonials from a few brokers, and I think that would be a good start.
One thing I do look for in a broker is someone who has a repeat service or a follow-up service. Because I know that after 2 years of having my home loan in place, that home loan rate is probably not going to be competitive anymore with my current lender, because banks' business model is kind of built on letting their existing customers' rates creep up in cost compared with what a new customer could get. So I'm always looking for a mortgage broker who is going to follow me up in 2 years' time and just automatically review my interest rate and be able to tell me that, yes, my interest rate is still competitive, or let's contact my existing lender to see if they can actually reduce my rate further, or let's take it to a different bank completely.
Yeah. I think that's an important point, Louis, is that any mortgage typically is going to be, you know, up to 30 years. So you've got to be having a real long-term view on how you're going to manage and minimize the cost of it. So having a mortgage broker that's going to be with you for the duration would be ideal.
Brett, any sort of closing remarks just to sort of round out today's topic?
Look, I think it's just a matter of being on the ball. If you're a current borrower, you really should be having a look at what you're currently paying, and making sure that if you are on a variable rate, it has come down. You know, your bank's one of them. If you're not, just be proactive and get in touch with either a broker, us, or someone you know, and make sure you're getting the best deal. I mean, money can be hard to come by at times, so you don't want to be giving it away where you don't have to.
Yeah, great advice. Guys, we're going to throw to our final section for the day, your favourite for the day as well. It's You Can't Be Serious. I know that I can see a few faces on this video conference looking for You Can't Be Serious funnies, so they better be funny this morning, guys.
Oh, Joel's been great for lately. What's he got for us today?
Well, he has. There is actually an article in the Mirror in the UK, the Daily Mirror in the UK, which outlines the unfortunate birthday present that one gentleman provided to his fiance, thinking that he would get her a really nice gin glass in which he could have engraved on that glass a lovely birthday message. When the glass arrived, the message wrote, "Can we have it delivered before Monday if possible, as that's the 30th. Nice one. So the engraver took down the delivery message, not the birthday message.
I love it.
quality.
She'll always remember her birthday was on a Monday.
Yeah, for that one. At least you would have known that he was prepared. So I've got to give him brownie points for actually having it delivered early.
So I've read that there has actually been some research done into why men have beards. With all the things that could be researched in the world, of course, this is one that some scientists will turn to. And the conclusion of these scientists is evolution-wise, the beards on men's faces, and specifically their necks and chins, allows them to be better punched in the face.
Hey, Joel, lucky you can't really grow one.
Yeah, Joel would be right.
Or unlucky. Unlucky. Yeah. Might have a glass jaw.
Well, we spoke before about football and how there won't be any crowds, and I've noticed around the world different sporting organisations have been going to different measures to try and create some atmosphere when crowds aren't allowed. I've seen lots of paper cutouts and ways to make it look like there are at least someone in the crowd. Well, a Korean football club has been caught out by having a partner they said supplies them with mannequins to try and establish a bit of a crowd. But their spectators were a bit more savvy than that, and they actually identified that they weren't mannequins but, in fact, sex dolls. And when pushed on it, yes, they did. Oh, we didn't investigate thoroughly enough, but, yes, we do admit a big portion of those mannequins were, in fact, sex dolls.
And closed either.
Maybe they wanted them to be just like real fans and come back to the change rooms with them.
Yeah. I was wondering why all the players kept going over to high five.
Good one, guys. All right. Well, look, have a fabulous weekend. Stay rugged up and warm inside because I hear it's going to be a cold one. And we will be back again next week. Thanks for having us for tuning in.
Thanks, Steph. Thanks, listeners. Cheers.
Bye. Bye-bye.